We've got quite a lot of material to cover today, so I'd like to go actually straight into the text now. So remember, we're following this text from Panchen Losen Chöki Gelson, who's writing down instructions in the Geluk tradition of Mahamudra. So remember, Mahamudra, the Great Seal, is a system of practice that was brought into Tibet through the Indian Mahamudra lineage of Tsalopa Naropa. And this forms the basis of the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. And Lama Tsongkhapa in the 14th, 15th century, who's considered to be the founder of the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism, he also had some great Kagyu teachers, and then he synthesized the oral Mahamudra instructions he received from them together with his own profound, unique way of coming to realize emptiness. And then we have the Geluk tradition of Mahamudra formed, which got passed down master to disciple to Panchen Losen Chögyi Gelson, who wrote this text on the practice. And what we saw previously in this text is that this Mahamudra practice, like every system of practice, we need to have a good foundation in that practice, so the preliminary practices, which we're looking at in each session after lunch. And then the actual Mahamudra practice, which is realizing emptiness in terms of the mind, or another way we can say is realizing the nature of the mind. We can do this practice at two levels, the sutra level, the tantra level. So remember, at the tantra level, we're trying to gain access to the deepest level of our mind, this very subtle mind, sometimes called primordial mind. In Tibetan, in the Nyingma tradition, it's often called Rigpa, also given many other names. So we briefly had a look at that level of practice. But in order to practice that, of course, we need to have a good foundation in the sutra level of practice, and that's what we're mainly focusing on in this text. And the sutra level of practice, of course, the two core elements of the practice is shamatha, vipassana. Shamatha, to cultivate a calm, clear, focused mind, and then vipassana practice, to come to realize the nature of the mind, to realize emptiness. So we're currently in the shamatha practice. And we saw in the shamatha practice that it's important to have good preparation for the shamatha practice, having a good environment to meditate in, and then, of course, at the beginning of each meditation session to prepare ourselves well. So we had a look at how to do that. And now we're on page 5, and we're looking at the actual session. And we saw just previous to that... we are cultivating these two qualities of stability and clarity, and that we need to overcome 5 faults using those 8 antidotes. And if we can overcome those 5 faults, and of course the first of the faults was laziness, the second fault was forgetfulness, forgetting the object, and then the third fault were the two main imbalances of dullness and distraction, or laxity and excitement. The fourth fault was non-application, meaning not adjusting the mind when we fall into dullness or distraction. And over-application is unnecessary adjusting of our focus. So if we can overcome those 5 faults using the 8 antidotes, and we saw there the two main tools we use in this practice, of course, is mindfulness and introspection. We can move along these 9 stages, which we briefly looked at in the shamatha diagram, and we can achieve shamatha. And then there was a question there just previously about what object to use for this practice. So of course here, since this is Mahamudra practice and the emphasis is focusing on the mind, we're using the mind here as the object of shamatha practice. But of course there are many possibilities of different objects to use for shamatha practice. And then we started to look at the actual beginning of the meditation session, once we've prepared ourselves well by having a good posture, setting a good motivation, and then at the end we dissolved the teacher into ourselves, and then we start. And then it said, within that state of fleeting appearances, It said, don't try to fabricate anything, don't alter anything, don't go into the past, don't go into the future, don't move around in the present, simply rest in the present moment for a short while, it said, for a short while, meaning in this practice we need to emphasize quality over quantity, so keep the session short. So if we continue on from there, so we're in the fourth paragraph down on page 5, it says, when resting the mind in this way, it is not that you stop attention like when fainting or falling asleep. Rather, station the guard of non-forgetful mindfulness so that the mind that is unwaveringly still does not become distracted. So we need to use mindfulness, the rope of mindfulness, to hold the object so that we do not become distracted. But then on top of that, it says here, it says in that way the observed object is bound by the rope of mindfulness. So that's the analogy, and we saw that in the diagram, the rope of mindfulness. If, however, mindfulness degenerates, there will be a great danger of the proliferation of thoughts that will move the mind. Therefore, it is necessary to set up introspection like a watcher to be aware of whether or not the mind is moving elsewhere due to the strength of mindfulness having become weak. So we need to monitor that mindfulness using introspection, quality control, to monitor that, to notice if we're becoming dull or distracted. So that's the second tool, the introspection, monitoring the mindfulness. And then there's a quote here from Baba Viveka, who was a great master, Indian master from about the 5th, 6th century. He says, the elephant of the mind that is out of control is to be bound with certainty by the rope of mindfulness to the firm post of the observed object. So we tie our mind to the observed object with the rope of mindfulness and gradually brought under control by the hook of introspection. In brief, accomplishing faultless meditative stabilization does not go beyond the manner of maintaining mindfulness and introspection. Furthermore, mindfulness is principle, and if this is present, then introspection, which is said to be the result of mindfulness, comes naturally. So these are the two main tools, and of them, of course, mindfulness is the principal tool. And here it says that if we keep strengthening our mindfulness, our ability to monitor that also naturally improves. In fact, because of that, in the shamatha texts, often in the Kagyu tradition, they don't even talk about introspection. They just simply talk about mindfulness, because that introspective ability is something that comes naturally the more that we focus. But of course, we have to be aware that we have to do that monitoring, otherwise we'll get dull and distracted and that's the end of our meditation. So now we're in the present moment and we have the tools of mindfulness and introspection. So what are we to do? So let's look at the next sentence. It says, attentively focus mindfulness on the clear and knowing nature of the mind and observe it single-pointedly and nakedly. So here it says attentively focus mindfulness. And very often in the meditation text here, it says things like firmly focus on the object. But remember, of course, many of us come into this practice from a lifestyle with a lot of stress and agitation, a lot of tension. And normally when we want to focus on something, we clamp down. So, of course, then often what people do is when they see this attentively focused mindfulness, oh, yeah, I can do that. And so then we naturally tighten the focus. And probably the main reason people have difficulty meditating as a beginner is because of this reason. Too tight, too tense, trying too hard. So we need to relax, relax, relax. I think, you know, when it says attentively focus, Remember, these texts were written centuries ago, you know, in ancient Tibet and India. And I think there people were much more relaxed than we are now, but probably too relaxed. And that's why they needed to emphasize, you know, you need to attentively focus, not to just sort of sit there like this as you normally do. So we need to be a little bit careful when we see these words and not to clamp down forcibly. Otherwise, we're going to have all sorts of problems in our meditation. So it says, attentively focus mindfulness on the clear and knowing nature of the mind. So here, when we talk about the nature of the mind, we can talk about the nature of the mind in two ways, or two types of natures. The first one is conventional nature of the mind, and then we can talk about the ultimate nature of the mind. And of course, the ultimate nature of the mind is referring to how does the mind exist. So the ultimate nature of the mind, of course, is emptiness. The fact that the mind is empty of independent existence. There's no independent mind, no inherently existent mind. The conventional nature of the mind is just conventionally the nature of the mind, or in general of things that exist conventionally. So often here then, when we have the conventional nature of something, often we get a definition of the conventional nature of things. And often in that definition, it's a two-word definition. The first word is sort of describing the entity of the thing, and the second word is describing its function, to describe the conventional nature of something. And so here we see the clear and knowing nature of the mind. So this is the conventional nature of the mind. The mind is clear and knowing. Sometimes this is translated as clarity and awareness. So in this two-word definition of the conventional nature of the mind, the first word here is again describing the entity of the thing. And the second word is the function. What does it do? Like, for example, the simple definition of fire. What's the conventional nature of fire? Is that fire is hot and burning. So what's the entity of fire? Is heat. What does fire do? It burns. So what is the entity of the mind? It's clear, or has clarity. What does the mind do? It knows. It is aware. So this is what the two words here mean. So clear, or clarity here, the mind being clear or having clarity really implies two things. One is that it's not physical, so the mind is not the brain. The second idea of what it means for the mind to be clear or have clarity is that it enables things to appear within it. A little bit like the idea that a mirror, because the mirror is clear, reflections can appear in a mirror. Because the mind is clear or has clarity, then appearances can appear in the mind. Thoughts, emotions, mental images, and so forth. So that's what the word clear or clarity means. And of course, function, the mind engages in appearances. The mind is aware, the mind knows. So this is what it's said here, is to focus the mind on the clear and knowing nature of the mind. So we're just simply focusing on the mind itself, and then these qualities, the clarity and knowing aspect of the mind, become of course more and more obvious to us as we focus. If we were looking at fire, the fact that it is heat is hot and it burns, if we pay close attention, becomes more and more evident. So here, as a beginner, of course, our mindfulness is not very good, so these things are not very evident, the fact that the mind is clear or has clarity and it's aware and so forth. But as we deepen the practice our mindfulness improves, then this becomes more and more obvious. And it says here that we are to observe it single-pointedly and nakedly. So single-pointedly and nakedly means to use bare attention, that we are observing the mind directly. We're not visualizing, we're not imagining, we are observing it directly. We're not commenting, simply with bare attention, observe it nakedly and directly. So that is what we are to do. So using mindfulness, we focus on the mind itself. Any questions about this? Of course, often we have a strong habit. Even if we're focusing on the sensations of the breath in the body, often we visualize, imagine. This is our strong tendency, is that we, in particularly our modern society, we're caught in our conceptual mind. You know, we're always thinking, conceptualizing. So we tend to conceptualize everything to the point where we don't actually experience the physical reality directly anymore. We see something, but then we project and imagine and all sorts of things. And of course, then we're out of sync with reality. So here with the mindfulness then, we can start to slowly become aware that we're not looking directly and to try and let go of any commentary or conceptualization or visualization or imagination as much as we can. So you probably will find here and in other shamatha practices of observing the breath, we probably will do that. We probably will, you know, visualize, imagine, and so forth, and just as much as possible to notice that and let go of that as much as we can. So we just need to develop a new, better habit of looking directly with bare attention. It takes some time. So here in the shamatha practice, we're observing this, and this becomes more and more obvious. So when we talk about realizing the nature of the mind, to realize the conventional nature of the mind, we have shamatha. So if we achieve shamatha, we have realized the conventional nature of the mind because we see this directly and clearly. Whereas to realize the ultimate nature of the mind, to realize the mind is empty of inherent existence, of course, is vipassana practice. Generally, of course, when we talk about, if we speak generally in Mahamudra, realizing the nature of the mind, normally we're implying this. So often when you see in the text, you come to realize the nature of the mind, most often it's referring to this. But we can make this distinction. Okay, then if we move on. So what are we to do then? So we're observing the mind with the rope of mindfulness. Introspection is monitoring if we're still observing, if we're becoming dull or distracted. But then here in the next paragraph, we have two sort of variations of the practice. In the next paragraph, it says, when observing in this way, whatever thought arises, simply recognize it. Such a technique relies upon introspection. So this is the practice that we've been doing. And that is, if a thought arises, simply recognize it. It means simply observe it arising and passing. So this is the shamatha practice of observing the mind, or as Alan Wallace calls it, settling the mind in its natural state. So to talk a little bit more about this practice, I'd like to again read a little bit from Alan Wallace in his Attention Revolution book. On page 83, he says the following. The object of mindfulness in the practice of settling the mind in its natural state is no longer the subtle sensations of the breath at the nostrils, because that was the previous practice that he described in the book, but the space of the mind and whatever events arise within that space. The object of introspection, as in the earlier practice of mindfulness of breathing, is the quality of the attention with which you are observing the mind. So again, introspection is monitoring that mindfulness. And then now he quotes actually a text from the tradition, the Mahamudra tradition. He says, at the beginning, have many daily sessions. So we saw that already, to keep to for a short while. So short sessions. Each of them of brief duration, and focus well in each one. We saw that, attentively focus. Whenever you meditate, bear in mind the phrase, without distraction and without grasping, and put this into practice. So now he's commenting, he says, as you venture into this practice, I would encourage you to memorize these quintessential instructions, which are, settle your mind without distraction and without grasping. Practicing without distraction means not allowing your mind to be carried away by thoughts and sense impressions. Be present here and now. So this is why he's talking about to simply recognize it, so we don't get carried away. Be present here and now, and when thoughts arise pertaining to the past or future or ruminations about the present, don't be abducted by them. As you hike on this trail of shamatha, don't be a hitchhiker catching a ride with any of the thoughts or images that whiz through your mind. Rather, be like a kestrel hovering motionlessly as it faces the wind, slightly moving its wings and tail feathers to adjust to the currents of the air. Even when your attention is settled in the present, you may still grasp onto the appearances to the mind. Whenever you prefer one mental object over another, whenever you try to control the contents of the mind, and whenever you identify with anything at all, grasping has set in. Here is the challenge at hand. Be attentive to everything that comes up in the mind, but don't grasp onto anything. So again, be attentive and simply recognize it, observe it. In this practice, let your mind be like the sky. Whatever moves through it, the sky never reacts. It doesn't stop anything from moving through it. It doesn't hold on to anything that's present, nor does it control anything. The sky doesn't prefer rainbows to clouds, butterflies to jet planes. Whatever comes up in the field of awareness, without grasp, distraction or grasping, just let it be. So just let it be means exactly that, is to simply observe it, and as the text here seems, recognize it, see it as a thought, as a image or so forth, and just observe it arise and pass, arise and pass. So of course, in the breath practice, if a thought arose, we had to let it go and come back to the breath. Here, of course, in this practice, thoughts are not problems. The problem is grasping to the thought. The problem is identifying with the thought and following it. So simply recognize it and observe it, let it be, and don't grasp on it to it and follow it. So this is the instruction here. So that's what we've been practicing. And then the second sentence in this paragraph describes something a little bit different, slightly different. And it says here, or alternatively, Just like the swordsman's battle with the archer taught in the Vinaya scriptures, having generated strong mindfulness and introspection, as soon as any thought arises, cut it off completely, not allowing it to continue. So the analogy here was that there was a battle between a swordsman and an archer. And the swordsman was very skillful with his sword. And then the archer was trying to shoot the swordsman with an arrow. And so as long as the swordsman could be completely focused, have complete mindfulness, and saw the arrow coming, he would be able to, with his sword, cut it or deflect it so the arrow wouldn't hit. But then, of course, when he lost mindfulness, then he got shot by the arrow. So the analogy here, of course, is that when we lose mindfulness, then, of course, we get shot by our thoughts. We identify with them and we follow them. So here, this practice actually is really talking about the awareness of awareness practice, where in this practice here, we're not actually observing thoughts arise and pass, but rather we are resting in awareness itself and just deflecting any thoughts that come, not paying attention to them. Of course, not trying to block them or suppress them. So let's have a little bit of a look at this practice, how Alan Wallace talks about it in his Attention Revolution again. So this is on page 144. He says the following. And he's quoting here Padmasambhava regarding this practice. So Padmasambhava, of course, was the great Indian master who brought Dzogchen teachings into Tibet. And Dzogchen is like Mahamudra in that it's a nature of the mind practice. So also in Dzogchen, in the Shamatha, they have similar practices. So he says the following here. He says, here are quintessential instructions by Padmasambhava on the practice of shamatha with no object apart from the awareness itself. So now he's quoting Padmasambhava, who says, vacantly direct your eyes in the space in front of you. See that thoughts pertaining to the past, future, and present, as well as wholesome, unwholesome, and ethically neutral thoughts, together with all the causes, assembly, and dispersal of thoughts of the three times, are completely cut off. Bring no concepts to mind. Let the mind, like a cloudless sky, be clear, empty, and evenly devoid of grasping. Settle it in utter vacuity. By doing so, there arises the quiescence of joy, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. So this is the practice that we are going to move into in our shamatha practice tomorrow morning, is the awareness of awareness practice. So remember, in that awareness of awareness practice, we're not focusing on thoughts arising, watching them arise and pass. We're simply deflecting them. We're simply ignoring them. We are simply resting in awareness itself. And I want to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow when we're doing the practice, but is there any questions about that practice now?
Yeah, what's the difference exactly between focusing on space and awareness of awareness?
Very good question. Of course, technically, you know, we said that awareness of awareness, I mentioned already, is a much more non-dualistic practice. And it's called shamatha with no object. Technically, you could say that the mind is the object, like as in the practice we've been doing, the space of the mind. However, experientially in the awareness of awareness, there's not a sense really of being a separate observer or witness. that we are more resting in the mind itself. So technically, in terms of the object, then awareness and observing the space of the mind in this practice are fairly similar, but experientially they're a little bit different, in that observing the space of the mind, there is a sense of being an observer and observing the space of the mind. Whereas in this practice of awareness, it's more about resting in the mind. So it's a little bit difference in perspective, that's all. And also in this awareness practice, as he mentioned here with Padmasambhava, and also Alan Wallace mentions himself, it's not so much one of cultivating stability and clarity as we do in the observing the mind and the breath, but in this practice it's more about discovering the stability and clarity that's already within the mind itself. So that's also a little bit different perspective, experientially. Any other points anyone would like to raise?
Yeah. Would you say it's more like the ocean and the waves?
Well, if we can use that analogy, if we use the analogy of the clouds in the sky, then in observing the mind is we're observing the sky and all the clouds that are going through it. And if there's no clouds going through it, we're just observing the sky. Awareness is not so much about observing the sky, it's about being the sky, like merging with the sky. It's a bit more like that. And also we'll find a little bit later in the Shamatha text here, the analogy of the ocean and the waves also fits quite well in one context that we're coming to, particularly when we, in the observing the mind practice, and we're observing thoughts, you know, often we feel as if, you know, thoughts are something other than the mind, you know, they have their own sort of unique nature or something. But what we will come to see, and that's described in the text, I think, in the next page, is that, like the analogy of the waves and the ocean, that they are the same nature, that they're both in the nature of water. And so that's going to be described a little bit coming up in the text on the next page. So these are the two approaches to practice. And we've, in terms of the mind, the one we've been using yesterday and today is, again, as Alan Wallace calls it, settling the mind in its natural state, is simply observing the mind and then whatever arises in the mind. And then the one we're going to be working with tomorrow and the following morning is the awareness of awareness practice, of simply resting in awareness itself. And again, many people find this even more challenging than observing the mind. Some people are actually naturally drawn to it. Some people, even from the very beginning, really are drawn and connect well with the awareness of awareness practice. And the reason that many people find it very difficult as a beginner is because this practice basically involves doing nothing. It involves just being aware. And it's not something we're very, very familiar with. We're always in doing mode. We always want to do something. So, and we're going to see that tomorrow, that part of the instruction there is just to really stop doing. Just be, just rest, just be aware. But we'll cover more of that tomorrow.
Okay. Can I ask about one question?
Sure.
Maybe after some time, I'm just thinking, okay, like
maybe I should look for something here, because it's very neutral. It doesn't have any taste or any mood or just nothing. So maybe I should look for boundaries of mind, or of just trying to add something to that, because okay, I already know that object, and what else? I'm trying to find something else, and how to keep that interest and that drive to do the same.
Yeah, exactly. And the main reason for that, of course, is that our driving force in our life is craving and attachment. We crave stimulation. We crave sensual stimulation. We crave intellectual stimulation. That's what we crave. And, of course, in awareness, there is none of these stimuluses. So when we're in that state, then often we're craving something. We want something to happen, because that's what our normal is that we normally search for happiness in stimulus, whether it's physical, sensual stimulus, sensory stimulus, or intellectual stimulus. But we crave stimulus, you know. I'm not sure, did I mention in this retreat already the study they did, Time Magazine? Did I? No, okay. No. What they did is that they had a room, and it was completely white. There was nothing in the room. There was no stimulus at all. Chair in the middle. And they got people to sit in the chair for 15 minutes. And all they had to do was just sit there and relax. And there was no stimulus. Sensory stimulus. And they gave them a choice. Either they could sit there quietly and do nothing for 15 minutes. The other alternative was they gave them a little device that could give them an electrical shock. That was the choice. 65% of men preferred to shock themselves rather than sit there quietly doing nothing, because they couldn't bear it. Women fared a little bit better. Only 25% of women preferred to shock themselves. But this is how much we're addicted to stimulus.
But the same was with mice, I think, or with rats. The same experiment?
No, this was with people.
Yeah, but the same was called with mice, and they also, like, the majority of mice chose to shock themselves.
Mm. So, but what we will find is that the more we can rest in awareness, and I mentioned that there were these three qualities of mind that become more and more evident as we progress along the path to shamatha: clarity, non-conceptuality, and bliss. The more that we can rest in awareness, the more these qualities become evident. So actually, then our mind starts to become very clear, it starts to become very peaceful and quiet, and starts to get very blissful. So this is, and this these experiences, the more we go into them, of course, the less we're going to start craving for any sensory stimulus, because those sort of stimulus pale into insignificance compared to this experience. But of course, the danger is that we flip our attachment, a craving, from sensory stimulus to this, as I already mentioned. So if we notice that craving or attachment's coming up because our mind is quiet, because our mind is clear, it's blissful, then we need to let that go. Otherwise, it's just going to block us in our practice. But anyway, I'm going to speak more about this tomorrow. Interested in something. So interest is a bit of a vague word. I mean, interest in terms of having some aspiration to do something. I mean, remember here in the shamatha, the first fault was laziness. The antidote first was faith, then aspiration, which is like interest. So that's actually an antidote to laziness, because that leads to effort. So if interest means some aspiration to do something, very good, if it's a virtuous activity. But often that interest gets polluted by craving and attachment. You know, I want this, I need this, I must have this. Then craving and attachment has polluted our aspiration, our interest, and then we're in trouble. So here, in this practice, you know, if we are, like in today's practice and yesterday's practice, if we prefer a mind that's still rather than thoughts, or we prefer nice thoughts rather than not so nice thoughts, then our aspiration and interest is degenerated into craving. So in this practice we've been doing, we should have no preference between nice thoughts and not so nice thoughts, no preference between being the mind still or thoughts. If we can have that no preference and just be present with whatever's there, then we can have the interest to continue the practice without grasping and craving some sort of experience or craving some sort of result. Okay, then let's continue on a little bit in the text. It says then, so whether we do each, when we do this technique of observing the mind, then it says, when the proliferation of thoughts has finally been severed, meaning that the thoughts start to die down and the mind starts to become quiet, and the mind is still, then without losing mindfulness or introspection, immediately loosen your concentration and relax into a state of meditative equipoise. And he's quoting here Machik Labdron, remember that great Tibetan yogini who developed that Chir system of practice. And she says, focus attentively and loosely relax. It is there that the mind can be settled. And he's quoting again Saraha, the great yogi, 8th century from Tibet, India, says, if you relax the mind that is bound by tightness, it will undoubtedly become free. So here we start to see this subtle balance between being too tight and too loose, that as we go deeper into the practice, we're going to need to relax more and more. So we're going to need to release the tightness. And this is what's being said here, is to loosen your concentration and relax. But of course, if you do that too much, then you fall into dullness. But if your mind is too tight, and that's often the case for us as a beginner, if it's too tight, the mind becomes very agitated. And there's a very nice little saying from Saraha, who we've quoted here, and he says the following in one of his texts, one of his dohas. He says, and he uses an analogy of a camel. He says, when tied up, a camel tries to wander in all 10 directions, meaning if you tie up a camel, it struggles to try to break free. And he says, when freed, it stays immovable and firm. I have come to understand the mind to be like a stubborn camel. Of course, if we tie our mind, if we constrict our mind, then our mind struggles against that and we become very agitated. So here, then we need to, as much as possible, we need to loosen our firm. Remember at the start, it said firmly, attentively focused mindfulness. But then, of course, as we progress in the practice, we're going to need to relax that more and more and go deeper and deeper into relaxation. And it says at the bottom then, in this way, relax without becoming distracted. So again, the challenge is to relax, but not too much, so then we fall into dullness. So following on that discussion, there's some more on the top of page 6. where he says, if your focus is too tight and you think that excitement is arising, relax it a little. If your focus is too loose and you think that laxity is arising, tighten it a little. So remember that analogy we mentioned yesterday about the guitar string and focusing. If it's too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Likewise here, if our mind is too tight or too loose, it doesn't focus well. By finding a balance between the two, being too tight or too loose, the mind is drawn away from the movement of thoughts. However, it is necessary to be cautious of laxity when there is a factor of stillness. So when the mind becomes still, it's very easy to drift into dullness. So we have to be alert to this. Remember yesterday we looked at the 9 stages, we talked about the rabbit on the back of the elephant. So that is this subtle dullness. We have to be alert to that. Particularly when the mind is still, it's easy to sink into that dullness. And then he's quoting a great master, Master Chandra Goman, who says, if I rely upon exertion, excitement will arise. And if I give it up, laxity will occur. Since it is difficult to find an appropriate balance, what should I do with my agitated mind? So he's basically saying that even more advanced practitioners have this challenge. That from the very beginning, of course, we have a challenge. I mean, as a beginner, of course, we have more bigger obstacles than just a little bit of being too tight or too loose. We have like falling asleep and being completely distracted. But as we progress, of course, we're going to really start to do this balancing act of too tight, agitation, distraction, too loose, dullness. So there's this constant balancing that we need to do. So remember we said that shamatha, right at the beginning of the section, it said shamatha arises from a non-equipoised mind, which is unbalanced mind, and then slowly we become balanced, single-pointed, and then we can achieve shamatha. So here we are moving along the stages, doing this balancing act. Sure.
How you practice in this case, the same as before, that you might try to relax some part go down or
yeah, sure. I mean, of course.
Maybe lose your object if you go.
Exactly. So that's right. I mean, there's always this balancing act. I mean, of course, if we're too relaxed as a beginner, then we're just going to sink into dullness. So we need to sharpen our focus a little bit. Now, and then we saw it in the chart, there's that flame there. We have to put like effort in our mindfulness. We need to exert ourselves. And so what you'll find then is that as a beginner, of course, we need to relax, relax, relax. But then if we're falling into dullness, we need to sharpen our focus. And we can do this, and generally, we, as a beginner, we tend to drift into either dullness or agitation and distraction. So to help balance, and I think I've introduced a little bit in a couple of the meditations, is that we can do this sort of balancing act that we're mentioning here, particularly if we're focusing on the breath, by on each out-breath. The out-breath is a natural time to relax. So we can do the relaxing on the out-breath. And then the in-breath is a natural time to sharpen the focus, to tighten the focus, to focus. So, you know, just previously we saw from Magic Lobdron, she said, focus attentively and loosely relax. So we can do the loosely relaxing on the out-breath and a focus attentively on the in-breath. So then hopefully we can sort of get a bit of a balance going there. So also on the mind, and in the beginning phases, we can remember, we can even, you know, if we're really finding that we're getting swept away on with the mind, we can anchor ourselves a little bit in the breath to start with. So we could, as a beginning point, focus on the breath mainly, and then a little bit in the corner of our mind focus on the mind, the thoughts, and then slowly more emphasis on focusing on the mind and less on the thoughts. So we can, as a beginner, be focusing on the mind, but still in the corner of our mind be aware of the rhythm of our breath, and then when we're breathing out, to relax our focus on the mind, and when we're breathing in, to sharpen the focus on the mind. So we still can do that even if we're observing the mind. We can still do that balancing act conjoined with the breath as a beginner, because it can be very helpful to do that. Of course, as we progress deeper into this mind practice, we won't need to, and we'll be more skillful. We won't need to conjoin it with the in and out breath, and we'll start to develop more the skill of noticing when we're a little bit tight and just relaxing a little bit, and when we're a bit loose, tightening a bit. So we'll become more skilled at that as we progress. But as a beginner, it can be helpful to tie it to the rhythm of the breath, that balancing act. That can be helpful. Okay. Anything else?
Such a question. When we observe thoughts, it is also thought that I will start to absorb thought, is it?
Okay. So as a beginner, now remember here, in all the shamatha practices, we're using bare attention, observing the object directly, whether it's the breath or the mind. But as a beginner, some mental commentary could be useful. Because as a beginner, we have to sometimes use mental commentary to remind us what we're supposed to do. And also, for example, in the breath practice, we can use a little bit of mental commentary in terms of counting the breath to help stabilize. And so similarly here in the mind practice as a beginner, a little bit of commentary to remind ourselves what we're supposed to do can be helpful. And a little bit of mental commentary like naming the mental event, like thought, memory. So a bit of labeling, conceptual activity can be helpful to stabilize. So these things as a beginner can be useful, but we need to be careful not to overdo it, because then it just becomes a distraction. Like, for example, in the breath practice, if we're counting the breath, but instead of merely counting, we're making a big commentary out of that, you know, oh, why is my breath so coarse now and all of this, then it's just another distraction. So there's what's called cost-benefit. Cost-benefit. We have to work out cost-benefit. So, of course, even counting the breath is a cost, because it's conceptual activity when we're focusing on the breath. But the benefit is that by counting, we avoid heavy distraction. So as a beginner, counting the breath, the cost-benefit comes on the benefit side. So we do it. But then as we progress in the practice, the cost-benefit means counting the breath becomes more of a cost than it is a benefit. Then we'll need to let go of it, because then it just interferes with focusing. Similarly here with the mind, is if we continue to do conceptual activity, reminding ourselves what to do, labeling and all that, eventually the cost-benefit becomes a cost and we'll need to let go of it. It's a little bit like the example, like, you know, when we learn to drive a car as a beginner, learning, we do a lot of commentary. We go, okay, what am I going to do? I've got to look in the mirror. I have to push that down. I have to do this. I have to look there. We remind ourselves of all the things we have to do. If we didn't, we couldn't begin to drive a car. But then slowly, as we become more proficient, we don't keep doing that, do we? It becomes an automatic process. So similarly here, it becomes an automatic process. We don't need that mental commentary, and it becomes an obstacle. I mean, you imagine now if you did all that commentary every time you drove a car, it'd drive you nuts, wouldn't it, if you had to do it all the time. Fortunately, we're skillful now at driving the car, so we don't need that mental commentary, and we just let it go. So similarly here, in this practice, in any shamatha practice.
What happens when we start to examine this thought?
Okay. Right. So the other point, of course, is that in shamatha practice, the goal of shamatha practice is developing a calm, clear, focused mind, whether you're focusing on the breath, the mind, or whatever. What we don't want to do in shamatha practice is start investigating, because this is vipassana practice. So you do shamatha practice when you're doing shamatha practice, and you do vipassana practice when you do vipassana practice. So, therefore, of course, questioning and investigating is a valid part of vipassana practice. We need to question and investigate to come to realize the nature of the mind, to realize reality. But then it's a vipassana practice. So we saw that in the, you know, in our shamatha chart, the monkey in the tree, you know, it said even virtuous thoughts at the time of shamatha is an obstacle. You need to let them go. So similarly, doing any sort of investigation is a vipassana practice. What we're actually going to see tomorrow when we go into the shamatha practice of resting in awareness, and we'll look at the instructions on that, and we're going to quote a little bit, I think, from Padmasambhava again. He actually does introduce a little bit of questioning in there. And again, it's cost benefit. That little bit of questioning can help to make the mind alert and thereby overcome dullness. But technically, it's a vipassana practice. So we need to be, again, do vipassana when we're doing vipassana and do shamatha when we're doing shamatha. Okay. Then moving on a little bit more in the text. Second paragraph then on page 6, it says, when you observe the nature of any thoughts that arise, they vanish and a pristine emptiness dawns. So here are a couple of things. When you observe the nature of any thoughts that arise, they vanish. So this is what normally happens in this practice of observing the mind, is that we sit there and something starts to come up and it's gone. Because we are observing the nature of thoughts. We are observing them directly. We're not feeding them. So there's nothing to keep them there. So you will find that if we can manage to observe the thoughts directly, then they will vanish. Most of them will vanish very, very quickly. They'll hardly come up. And mindfulness, our mindfulness is not so good now, and like if we look at the sort of continuum of the mind, and this is like sort of a bit of a timeline, then now something may be appearing to our mind, but it doesn't register. There, something needs to appear to our mind for a minimum length of time before it registers. You know, and we know that from, and they've done studies on that, you know, they used to do these subliminal things they used to put on the TV or something. They'd flash something on the TV, very short, where you wouldn't see it, but somehow at a deeper level you would register. So similarly here, now, what we'll find is that sometimes there is things coming up, but they're so quick that they don't register. Or, remember also we talked about that our mind, we have a certain threshold. And above that, we can see the coarse-level mental activity. And below that threshold, sometimes called the subconscious or unconscious, there is mental activity going on, but it doesn't register because our mind is not clear enough. So in this shamatha practice, as our mindfulness improves and our mind becomes more stable and more clear, what you're going to find is that two things. One is the minimum amount of time for something to appear before it registers will get less. And they've done some scientific experiments on meditators for this. They've seen that for meditators, for the average person, a certain amount of time needs to elapse before they register something, recognize. But with highly qualified meditators, that time, the minimum amount of time necessary for something to appear, is much less. So we will also start to pick up things that are shorter in duration because more mindfulness and clarity. Not only that, but also here, with improved mindfulness, this threshold will go down, which means we're going to start to notice not just shorter mental events, but more subtle mental events. We're going to be able to start to pick up as we progress in the practice. So I just thought I'd add that a little bit here. And then in that first sentence, it also says, a pristine emptiness dawns. This doesn't mean that we're realizing emptiness. And this word emptiness here is really talking about emptiness is a lack of independent existence. It's an absence. So here, then, when a thought arises and then it vanishes, what's left is a lack of the thought, a space of the mind. So that's what's being referred to here. The pristine emptiness dawns means this absence, this vacuity dawns, this absence of thought, this space of the mind is dawning. It doesn't mean here we are realizing emptiness, we're realizing the ultimate nature of the mind. And then in the next sentence it says, similarly, if you also investigate when the mind is still, there is an unobstructed, clear emptiness, so again, this clear vacuity, this clear absence, and vivid clarity. So also when the mind is still, meaning the gap, you're just observing the space of the mind, that's what you see, this unobscured, clear vacuity, vivid clarity. And then it says, in seeing that there is no difference between the former and latter states, it is well known to meditators as the mixing of stillness and movement. So here, we can use, as we just briefly mentioned before, this analogy of the waves and the ocean, in that the ocean and the waves are the same nature, that they're both the nature of water. So here, similarly, whether the mind is still or whether the mind is moving with thoughts, we come down to the same thing, clarity and awareness. So the thoughts are not some other stuff, other nature than the mind itself. So that's what it means by the mixing of stillness and movement. And here we can also talk a little bit about how we're progressing in this practice. Now, what we saw previously in this shamatha chart is we have these nine mental abidings. They are nine stages where the mind is abiding better and better on the object. And so that's the model that's normally presented for how to progress in the shamatha practice. But also we have when we talk about using the mind as the object for shamatha practice, usually we use, in the Mahamudra tradition, there's a different model that's presented. And that can be seen a little bit on one of your charts, your handouts, the nine stages leading to shamatha. So we can briefly look at that now. So here we have the nine stages, down the left side. So that's the traditional. And then it gives, you know, and then the third column, that those six powers we talked at, and then it talks about what we achieve, what problems there are, and so forth. So some of those things we discussed when we looked at those nine stages. But then if we go down to the very last column, we see involuntary thoughts. So here, this one, and it's divided into five steps, sometimes it's divided into four. This is usually often the model that you'll see being presented when it comes to shamatha practice, observing the mind. That the stages of practice that we go through are described in this way. Because at the beginning stage of this practice of observing the mind, what we notice, of course, is that there are thoughts all over the place. And the analogy here, as we see at the top, is like a waterfall of thoughts. That at the beginning stages of practice, there's a waterfall of thoughts crashing down. So it's just one thought after the other, non-stop, because that's our normal state of the mind now. So that's the first stage of practice. And so we see that that is correlated to the first three of the nine stages that we looked at. That at stage one, stage two, and stage three, those mental abidings, typically in those three stages, we have that experience that there's this waterfall of thoughts crashing down. But then by stage four and five, we're focusing on the object better. And then the amount of mental activity starts to settle down a little bit. Meaning instead of a waterfall of thoughts crashing down, we see here a river quickly flowing through a gorge. So a fast moving river. And then we see that if we keep doing this shamatha practice, observing the mind, we're not feeding the mental events, then we're going to start to notice these gaps between when one thought finishes and another thought starts. Those start to get bigger, so there'll be more gaps than, or the gap or the stillness will start to become more, and the movement of thoughts will become less. And so then we see here, correlated to stage six and seven, the analogy here is that thoughts are like a river slowly flowing through a valley, which means the amount of mental activity has slowed down. There's much more gaps, much more stillness evident than movement. Then if we continue to practice, of course, and the mind progressively becomes more still, then the next part of the analogy is that that slow-moving river then empties into a still lake or ocean. So that's here corresponding to stage eight. When we have single-pointed attention, our mind is now becoming very, very still. And in this, so often then there are those four stages given. The waterfall, fast-flowing river, slow-moving river, emptying into a still lake. But here, and in some cases, they sort of add a fifth one to distinguish a little bit a difference at the end. And so it says here, then the conceptually discursive mind is still like Mount Meru, the king of mountains. So here, then, it's sort of making a distinction at two more very subtle levels. But often those two are grouped together, and just the analogy of a still lake or an ocean. So this is the model that is most commonly presented in Mahamudra when we talk about how to progress the stages that we go through in our practice. Because what we experientially see is the amount of mental activity slowly dying down. So that's the markers of progress in this practice. So it's a little bit a different perspective, that when we're using the breath as the object, we have more the what's called the mind perspective, the mind abiding on the object better and better. So that's why they're called the nine mental abidings. We're abiding better and better on the object. So that's from the perspective of the mind abiding. Whereas here in Mahamudra, it's more from the event perspective. How are the events unfolding in the mind? At first, waterfall of thoughts crashing, then fast-flowing river of slow-moving river emptying into a still lake. So this is sort of an attempt here to sort of correlate a little bit the two models in this chart. Again, this is from Alan Wallace, this model. I mean, not the model, the chart, rather. The model existed, of course, in the old ancient Mahamudra tradition. So here, as I briefly mentioned, one last point and then it's lunchtime, is in this practice then, what is really the door of entry into this practice of observing the mind is a little bit related to this mixing. And that is that to be able to distinguish the stillness of our awareness from the movements of the mind. Now, of course, when our mind moves, when a thought comes up, we identify with it and follow it. Whereas if we now are becoming the observer or witness, and we're observing the space of the mind, and the space of the mind, of course, is still, it's always still, if we can distinguish that stillness from when a movement occurs, when a thought occurs, and we can stay in that stillness and not get caught up in the thought, then we are entering into this practice. And so that's the door of entry into this practice, being able to distinguish that stillness of awareness, the space, from the movements of the mind, the thoughts. To be able to see those thoughts arising in that space, abiding in that space, and then dissolving back into that space. That's when we enter into it. Because now, as I said, we can't do that generally, and we just identify with the thought and follow it. Okay. Any last questions? Otherwise, it's time for a lunch break. Okay. Let's break for lunch. Come back at 2, and again at 2 o'clock we'll go back a little bit into the preliminaries, the foundation, and then we'll continue on with this shamatha in the afternoon sessions. I hope to finish the shamatha section today, getting onto the vipassana section of the text tomorrow morning.